Shalom, everybody. This is Jeremy Gimpel with Ari Abramowitz. It is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day here in Israel, and all of the programming today will be centered around this sacred day. We have with us a tremendous honor, someone who lived through the horrors of the 1930s and 40s and has lived a marvelous life, is now a great-grandmother here in Jerusalem. And, you know, sometimes you think about, well, someone had a hard childhood and they came up and they ended up in prison and they became rough and tough. And the story you're going to hear today is of the roughest and toughest that I've ever heard of, and the flower that blossomed out of the rough and the sand and the impossibility of human survival. I would say she's my mother's best friend. She's the dearest friend of my family, and it's just such an honor to know Rena Quint. She's speaking 5 times over Holocaust Memorial Day all across Jerusalem, and we snagged her into the studio for just a brief interview, and it's just an honor to have you on the show, Rena. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for that introduction. I feel very good about it.
Oh, good. So what I want to first do in this part of the show is, you know, there's so many stories, but your story is so beyond. I want people to know who you are and, you know, where you've come from and what you went through as we sort of acknowledge this day today. Could you tell us your story from the beginning?
My story, I think that every survivor who survived, survived by the miracle. And my story is different from many stories. First of all, 1.5 million children perished, and I survived. That already makes me different. Most children who did survive did so by being in hiding and forced papers in convents. Very few children went through the camps. I went through the ghetto, several concentration camps. I was liberated from Bergen-Belsen, which was a horrific concentration camp. And then I went to Sweden, and I was adopted in America. My story is different because when you lose your mother and your father and your brothers and the whole family, they're gone forever. I was different because every time I lost a mother, somebody came along and became my new mother. And when that person disappeared, somebody else was there. I had 6 mothers, and I believed that it was normal and natural to have these mothers. I didn't know that it was different.
You grew up just thinking that that's the way children grew up, with multiple mothers.
There was no other way of my thinking. I didn't know anything else.
How could a child live through those concentration camps in a real way? Do you have memories of what it was like, how it happened?
I have many memories of different things. I don't know how it happened. I don't know how anybody survived. I certainly don't know how I possibly could have survived. My brothers, my parents were much smarter and older. I was between the ages of 3.5 and 9.5. Ghetto, Pietrzykow was the first ghetto that was established when the Nazis came in 1939. We lived in the Jewish section, and so people in surrounding areas who weren't to live there had to move into the ghetto. And then people in surrounding towns and villages couldn't live there. They came in. So our house and everybody else's house got very crowded. And people who couldn't find a house had to sleep either in the mikveh or in the synagogue or in the street. And many of them, of course, died. At one point, the Germans decided to take able-bodied people like my father to labor, slave labor. And my father was taken to a glass factory. I remained in the house with my mother and my 2 brothers, Yossi and David. But at one point in 1942, the Nazis decided that they didn't want any Jews in the ghetto left, and they rounded up 2,000 people. In the middle of the night, they came knocking down, banging down the doors with guns, with whips, with revolvers, with anything that you can imagine, yelling, "Everybody, raus, raus, schnell!" And we had to run down the steps, taking whatever you could that you were able to gather. Some people took pictures, some people took food, some people took a blanket, some people took their babies. You had to have 2 hands to carry things, and we were taken out to the big square. All the houses in Poland are built around squares. And from there, we were herded through the streets like a herd of animals, being chased and beaten until we got to the synagogue. The rabbi in that synagogue at that time was Rabbi Lau. He perished at the same time with 2,000 others in Treblinka, but his son, Yisrael Meir Lau, became the chief rabbi, and now his grandson is the chief rabbi of Israel. His mother did not make it, and his other brother did not. We were taken through the streets.
What did you take with you, Raina?
I took nothing. I was about 5 or 6, and I don't know what I did. I think what I took was my mother's hand. I imagine that's what a little girl wants to do, is hold on tightly to her hand or her skirt or to anything that was there. It was my mother and my brothers. And we were brought into the synagogue. Everybody was screaming. As we ran down the stairs, people fell on top of each other. It was bedlam. When we got into this big, beautiful synagogue, only half of the people were able to get in. There were others in another room, and the people who couldn't get into the room, they took out into the forest. Those people had to dig their own graves, and they were shot into those graves. I was in this big room, and I have pictures where there are bullets in the ark, in the Aron Kodesh. Bullets were flying. Bats were being broken on people's heads. I don't know how this possibly could have happened. I am sure as a little girl, I must have been 5 and a half or 6. I really don't know exactly how old I was, because I didn't find my birth certificate until 1989 when I went back to Poland.
Wow. But do you remember the fear? How were you feeling at this point?
Very fearful, not knowing what was happening. But everybody was fearful. I think probably the adults feared more than the children, because the children had no idea what was happening, except that they were being beaten and shot. I cannot imagine how this possibly could have happened, of what happened to me. Because I sure, as a little girl, I must have been holding on to my mother. That's what children do. I'm sure my mother must have been holding on to me. That's what mothers do. There was a door in the synagogue, in the back of the synagogue, which I saw 2 years ago when I went back again. It's still there, but now it's a library. And there was a man on the other side. I don't know if he was really an uncle of mine or somebody whom I called uncle. It was a polite way of addressing a person. And he told me to run. My name at that time was Fredjo Fredel. And he beckoned to me and he said, run. Either I was very stupid, I was very naive. Maybe my mother told me to run. Maybe God told me to run. I don't know how a little child can do this, but I ran. The soldiers easily could have shot me, could have bopped me over the head, could have chased me, could have done anything. Either they didn't see me, because there was such confusion and tohu vavohu, or maybe they felt, let somebody else kill her. How far will she run? I ran out. I ran out of the synagogue. That was the last time I saw my mother and my brothers and the rest of the family and all friends and neighbors. They were all taken to Treblinka, the ones who weren't shot in the forest, and they were sent into the gas chambers. And then they didn't even have crematorium at the time. Their bodies were burnt on open pits. When you go to Treblinka now, you can still see, now there's 17,000 stones commemorating the 840,000 people who were murdered in Treblinka. I cannot imagine what my mother's last thoughts were. Was she worrying about the boys she was taking someplace unknown? Or was she worried about the little girl she left behind? What would happen to her? And I think it would be amazing for her to see that I'm in a studio in Jerusalem being able to talk about it. Uh-huh. Or if I've gone back to Poland in Treblinka and tried to talk to her, to tell her, yes, I did survive. I'm so sorry that nobody in the whole family survived. But I wish you could be looking down to see the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that have come from you.
Well, Raina, I want to hear the rest of this story. You escaped from the synagogue. You ran off as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old girl, just into the streets, not knowing where to go.
No.
Into the forest.
No. No. This man, who was my uncle, took me to my father. My father was working in the glass factory, except that I wasn't supposed to be as a little girl or as a little boy. So he changed me into a man of 10. He gave me a new name, Froyim. He said that I was 10 years old. He gave me boys' clothes. He cut my hair. And I became one of the men and worked
and
in
you're
the
saying
factory.
As a five-year-old girl,
maybe
you were
six.
Able to, oh, six, seven, eight.
What, no, no, probably
but
five.
But I'm saying even an eight-year-old, but a six-year-old, all the more so, you had the mental presence and wherewithal to dress as a boy and to play that role.
I don't think I did it. I think my father, everything that happened to me, somebody else helped me do. I wasn't smart enough. I just went along with everything, and I just had the mazel. I think God led me through the way. There's no way a child of five or six could pretend and could work. I worked. I worked in the glass factory. I brought water to the men to drink. I don't think the Germans cared about them being thirsty, but it was very hot there, and if they wouldn't be drinking, they would just faint. So I worked. I worked very hard in the factory.
Wow.
Until they decided they didn't want us there anymore.
And then where did you go?
Then there was another roundup, and we were taken to the Umschlagplatz and put on these cattle cars.
What is the Umschlagplatz?
Umschlagplatz is a place where the cattle cars that come, and people from different places are rounded up to be brought into these boxcars or cattle cars. In Warsaw, there's a place there with a big monument. In Pietrzykow, it's just a grassy plain.
And so where did the cattle carts take you?
Well, six extermination camps, Majdanek, Auschwitz, Chełmno, Belzec, Treblinka, they were all in Poland. Why? Because most of the people they wanted to kill were in Poland, because all the train tracks led into places like Auschwitz and Majdanek, because the Polish people were willing to see that, and Germans certainly didn't want it on their territory. But when the Germans realized that the Allies were coming closer, they started evacuating people from Poland and sending them to other places. Someone like Anne Frank, who was in Auschwitz, was sent to Bergen-Belsen, and many other people. They sent them out on these death marches.
But at this time, you're still with your father.
I'm with my father as a boy. But after we crossed the Polish border to the German border, after being in those cars for about 3 days with nothing to eat, with nothing to drink, with one pail as a toilet, and if you have 80 people, 80 to 100 people in a car, how long will that pail last? The smell, the stench was just impossible. You cannot describe it. Even if you're there, you can't describe it. And I don't know how anybody lived through it. If you ask me these questions, it's impossible. It's impossible that I'm here, and it's impossible that anybody survived.
I'm just wondering if you can still put your consciousness in the mind of young Rena Quint or Friedel at that point.
Fredje Lichtenstein.
And do you remember the pangs of hunger? Do you remember that hunger? The thirst? 3 days, I imagine it's...
You know, I don't know that I think about it, but when we got out of the cars, I do remember snow on the ground, and we ate the snow, and we drank the snow, and we looked at the light to see who was around there. But I don't remember what my mother's face looked like, and I don't remember my father. So there are many things that I don't remember, but many things that I wasn't sure about now, with the help of Barbara Sofer, who's writing the book, I have found. All kinds of. I found my birth certificate. I found my brother's birth certificate. I found my parents' marriage license. As a matter of fact, they were married by Rabbi Meir Shapiro, wow, who is a well-known rabbi. He was the rabbi in town before Rabbi Lau came in. But I can't remember what they looked like. So there's certain things that I can't remember, but I know. The smells I can remember.
And so they took you then to Bergen-Belsen. Is that where they took you?
Well, what happened is when we got off the cars, there were two other factories. From one was a woodworking, one was tanning, and they had men and women. And as soon as we got off there, Germans came. They looked perfectly clean and neat, and we were filthy. And they made this announcement that we were being taken to camps, men on one side, women to the other. My father knew that when you'd go into a camp, I don't know if he knew anything about gas, but everybody knew that you'd have to go for disinfection because we were so filthy with lice and with all the excrement and everything. Germans didn't want to be around people like that. But if you go into disinfection, what would happen? It means you have to go into a shower. My father realized if I get undressed, they would say I'm not one of the men or the boys, and they would kill me and they would kill him. And anybody else who helped us. And he met a school teacher who had come from the other one of the other factories, and he asked her to keep an eye on me. He gave me some pictures. He kept on saying to look at them and to remember that everything will be okay and to go with it. She became my new mother. But I don't remember her either, except that I know she gave me life. Everybody who helped me helped save my life. But eventually she also left.
So now you've been separated from your father, and now you're being under the guidance of a school teacher on your way now to another camp.
We went to Bergen-Belsen. And as we were marching up on the snow mountains, down in the ravine, there were two men lying with their pants down. And I don't remember at that time if I knew what it was. But years, looking back years later, I realized that if a Jewish woman ran away, maybe she could pretend to be a Christian. A Jewish man, if he was circumcised, was a dead giveaway. Only the Jews at that time. And that kind of thing, I remember, lying in the freezing snow. I remember that my toes were frozen. And when I came to New York, my adoptive parents took me to a doctor to see what do you do with a frozen toe. He had really never seen. It's not like frozen cold. This is frozen frost, because we didn't have shoes as we were walking. And as we were walking to Bergen-Belsen, my father had given me some pictures, by the way, which was very important, and he promised that he would meet me in our hometown in Pietrakov, but he never kept that promise. Eventually, he wound up in Buchenwald because I found a paper where he signed in, like you sign into a hospital or to jail, he signed in. I don't have anything from Bergen-Belsen because Bergen-Belsen was totally burned down because it was so infected with disease. There are lots of pictures that the British just burned it down. The Germans had tried to burn down a lot of things or to erase a lot of things so that the Allies wouldn't find what they had done.
Did they intentionally keep those records? I know they're meticulous about record keeping.
Not in Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen was totally burned down. So they don't have those records. So I have no idea when I came into Bergen-Belsen. I know when my father got into Buchenwald, so I imagine it was about the same time. But Bergen-Belsen was totally destroyed, the Jewish part.
So what did you do in Bergen-Belsen?
I don't think I did anything in Bergen-Belsen. I think they kept the children. There was some sort of hope of a trade, but there never was one.
How long were you there?
Well, I don't know when I came in. I know that we were liberated April 15th.
Of what year?
1945. And then I stayed there for a while, and then I was taken to... Well, what happened was that every day people died, and every day they were taken out, and there were corpses all over. And the smell, you never forget the smell. The smell was all over there. And one day I was just very sick. Apparently I had typhus. Now I know proof because I had the records from Sweden that I was in the hospital there. And typhus is the kind of thing where you can't keep your head up, your eyes, your ears, everything. I just lay down with... There was a pile of people who are dead or half dead, and everybody knew they were going to die. Everybody talked about it. She died yesterday, and she died the day before, and today she looks like she's going to be dead any hour. So you knew that if you don't die today, you'll die tomorrow or the next day. And being very sick and feeling, you know, this is sort of the end, not knowing anything about life, all of a sudden things changed. There were soldiers who were wearing different uniforms, and they were acting very kindly. And people were running and talking, and people were yelling that we're free. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know I wasn't free. It was April 15th, 1945. The British had come in and liberated the camp. And when they came in, they found 10,000 bodies, naked bodies lying around, and the smell and the stench permeating the whole area. The first thing they had to do was bury. And with bulldozers, they had these big pits and shoveled bodies in. 1,000 bodies, 2,000 bodies, till they got rid of all the dead bodies. They burned down all the barracks because we had been sleeping on straw with lice and fleas and all these different diseases. Everybody had dysentery. If you ate or you didn't, your stomach. And then they tried to feed the people who could walk on their own. 14,000 people died after the war. The British claimed that 2,000 died because they gave them the wrong food. Because when somebody hasn't eaten for such a long time, you have to be careful. And people were so hungry, they were gobbling down or eating things that they couldn't. Then they took care of people like me who were very sick, but they gave us medicine. And the barracks that the Germans lived in were not burned down because they were made out of brick and cement. And they made a makeshift hospital, and there was a school nearby, and they gave us medicine. And because I was one of the lucky ones at that time, as bad as things were before, I did have the luck. First of all, I survived. Sweden, that had not been at war, had opened its doors to 6,000 German prisoners of war. Not prisoners of war, victims of the war. And we were invited to come to Sweden.
And you went there now at this point alone with no parental guardian? Just to Sweden as an orphan?
Yes, I came to Sweden. I don't know what happened to my mother. That's right, to that mother. But when I got to Sweden, I met somebody else who claimed to be my cousin. And she became, but I was very sick. And so I was taken to a Swedish hospital.
You say claimed to be your cousin.
I don't know who she was. I don't remember who she was. There was always somebody with me. I know that many people in concentration camps say that people were on their own and everybody had to take care of themselves and the survival of the fittest. Not with me. I always had somebody whom I could attach myself to. It's not like a mother who gives you a kiss goodnight or who sings to you or who hugs you or loves you, but there was always somebody there. And that was very, very important. And all these people, I think, helped save my life. I don't think a child between 3.5 and 9.5 could have done it on their own.
Well, how do you explain that? How do you explain someone who is themselves fighting for their own existence, whatever shred of bread they have? It seems like the opposite of the time when you would actually go out and adopt and bring someone in. Well, how do you explain that mother after mother took you in and made you their own daughter with the liability that you presented for them?
I don't know that I can explain it, but I think that just the way I needed a mother, maybe they needed a child. If they lost their child, they needed someone to help with them. My husband once explained to me in the Gemara, it talks about a cow and a calf, which is more important. The cow is very necessary to the calf to give milk, but the calf can't. They need the milk, but the cow can't live without giving the milk. She will die and be in pain. So maybe it was that kind of thing. I can't explain it to you. It just happened. Everything's
it's just miraculous, the whole story.
Yes.
And so now you're a little girl in Sweden, orphaned by yourself, picked up by who claimed to be a cousin.
Right, but I was six. So I was taken to a Swedish regular Christian hospital. And there a Christian family came to visit me, and they brought me a doll and apples. And I even have a gift that I still have with me. And they wanted to adopt me, and they asked me if I wanted to come and live with them. And I really wanted very much. They were very, very kind and good to me. But the people around me said that I was Jewish, and I belonged in a place called Palestine. Unfortunately, there was no Israel in 1945. There was a Palestine. And the people around me said that I should go to Palestine, where I would meet my mother and my father and my brothers. And that's where all the orphans were going to go. And so that's what I was going to do. And when I got better, I left the hospital. I was taken to a second DP camp, a second displaced persons camp. And there I met a new mother. I don't know what happened to the other woman. All these people sort of disappeared. The new mother's name was Anna. And she had a son, Sigmund, and a daughter, Fanny, who was 9.5. Her brother had gone to the United States before the war. And he sent her papers. Somebody had to sponsor you to come to the United States. The United States was also not so great. No country wanted the Jews. No country. Everybody had a quota. But she was on the German quota, and she was able to get in, and they sent her all the papers and tickets and money to come to the United States. While they were waiting for the ship, and while I was waiting to go to Israel or to Palestine, her daughter Fanny died. Her death was my luck. And her mother asked if I'd like to come as her daughter. I got her name. I got her birthday. I got the place that she was born in, which is Germany, which my passport says. I got a new mother. I got a new brother. And we came to America.
Wow.
and came. We saw the Statue of Liberty. We saw the big houses. I got a new outfit, all the food I wanted. The ship was beautiful. And when we came to America, we were taken to a place called Lyndhurst, Long Island. And the children right away started teaching me English. I didn't speak any language well. Yiddish was the common language in the camp. And
that was a new life then in America.
It was a new life in America, and everything was wonderful. I got a baby doll carriage, which I never had before. And this was in March. And in July, we went to the Catskill Mountains to a summer place where people had their little kachalein, little places to live.
Folks, this is Rena Quint, a survivor of the worst tragedy maybe on all of human history. Stay tuned as we come back in just a bit.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Welcome back to Israel Inspired Radio. This is Jeremy Gimpel with Ari Abramowitz. We're here with Rena Quint, a Holocaust survivor who has a story like no one else. And we finally escaped Europe. We've made it to New York, a new life. And you're now up in the Catskills in summer camp for the first time.
And I went blueberry picking and we did all the right things and I had a wonderful time. But one day Anna disappeared, my new mother. Didn't worry me so much because all the ladies there, all the women, gave me food and I had a bed and nobody was being shot. But a few days later, they came back with this big black car. Everybody was crying. Nobody explained to me what it was. Anna had died. Oh, yeah. And I told you, a lot of people died. Her daughter died. She died. A lot of people died after the war because they were so weakened. And everybody was crying. One person died and everybody was crying. And it didn't make any sense because in Bergen-Belsen, hundreds of people died and nobody cried.
Death was a way of life. It was so commonplace.
Right.
That now it was an ordeal and a drama.
Right. And I didn't understand this, but slowly you understand everything after a while. Nobody explained it. I never told anybody I was a Holocaust survivor. I didn't want them to know. I was filthy and filled with lice and filled with sicknesses. And nobody asked. It was just not something we discussed. But we went home to Pesach Shiva, and the family that brought Anna over now had a problem because they brought over a woman who was going to take care of her children. But now that she wasn't here, they really didn't want to have another mouth to feed. And there was a lot of discussion, I guess. I was not part of this. But apparently one of the people in that family knew a family in Brooklyn, New York, Leah and Jacob Globe, and I was invited there for Shabbat, for the weekend. And I went there. They also gave me a doll and a new dress and all the food I wanted. And when it was time to go back, they said, would you like to stay and be our daughter? Well, by now you know that I thought every time you get a new mother and it's fine. And I became their daughter. They changed my name from Fredja Fredel, which means joy, to Rena. It's the same name. It's
in
just
Hebrew.
It's Hebrew name. In 46, it was a new name. Now it's a very common name.
Yeah.
And I became an American princess. I got everything. I went to school. I had to learn English. Some of the schools that they wanted to send me to, private, they didn't accept me because I didn't speak English and I didn't speak Hebrew and I didn't know math. I knew nothing. I had no education whatsoever. At 3 and a half, you don't go to school. And starting with that time, my life was really very, very good. And in 81, there was a gathering of Holocaust survivors. And my family said, you know what? Why don't you go and see? Maybe somebody else survived. So we came to Israel, and we looked, and we put up signs. Nobody recognized me, and I didn't recognize anybody. So we wrote to Arlson, which is an international tracing bureau, and they wrote back to me. They have a lot of information, and anybody's looking for information. Now you can find it on the web. In 1981, you had to go through the International Swedish International Red Cross. And they told me, yes, I was born in Pietrakov. Yes, I was in the various camps. Yes, I was in Bergen-Belsen in Sweden. Case closed, child adopted in America. So here I was, this case adopted in America. In 84, we made Aliyah. And my husband and I and our four children, my husband and I decided to volunteer, and I volunteered in Yad Vashem. In 89, Yad Vashem had a trip to Poland. As terrified as I was of going, we went. And it turned out to be an amazing trip because I found my birth certificate and I found my brother's birth certificates and I found my house. And the Christian woman let us in and we found a mezuzah still on the door.
Wow. What were the feelings you had when you arrived back to that place of your genesis, of your origin, of your... was it traumatic for you?
It was unbelievable. You know, I'm a different person. I'm a different person now. I went back 2 years ago, and Barbara, the person who's writing this book about me, is she sees everything and knows everything, and she asked me that question, how I felt. I said, it was a different person. The sun was shining. When I was there, the sun never shone. It was a marathon. People were running. I couldn't imagine anybody. Music was playing. We stayed in a beautiful hotel. I was so out of it that when I came into the hotel, I asked the bellhop there if I could drink the water. And it's a 5-star hotel. Of course you can drink the water. I drank the water in Bergen-Belsen in puddles. Why am I asking this? Because I'm a different person. It's a different world. You just can't compare it.
Wow.
Well, let me just, you know, ask you, those years, those young years are so formative in ways that we're not even conscious of or aware of, but the basic human bonds are forged at that point. I hope this isn't too personal, but if I could ask you, was it difficult to have normal, normative relationships at that point, familial relationships, to know how to be a mother when you had 8 of them yourself?
Six.
Oh, so, I'm sorry, six. We were talking,
You just don't think of the past. You do everything together. A few months ago, I cracked a tooth, and I had a hole there, and I went to the dentist, and I said, oh, boy, I'm going to have a big, expensive job. And he said, no, it's just a little thing. You just have to fix it. I said, when is the tooth? It's a molar. When did I get that molar? You have 6 and 12-year-old molars. The one that I broke was a 6-year-old molar. I said, could you tell me how a child without food, without calcium, without all the things that you think are important, can have good teeth? He said, I don't know. Must be in the genes or something. I don't know.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, when I was in Jerusalem, when I first got here, the second week I was here, I was at a bombing on Ben Yehuda Street. I was thrown to the ground. And for years afterwards, to some degree, even today, when there was like any sort of explosion, construction work, I fell to the ground. I'm just wondering if you have those sort of Pavlovian associations. Dogs, for example, my grandmother won't get near them. She says dogs are for hunting Jews. Do you have those type of traumas carrying over even from your youth until now?
I've had dreams. I've had bad dreams. I have a capacity of waking myself up to say, it happened, but it's not happening now. We have a country. We have a government. I have a family. I have a husband, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. We love each other. We're together. And you just don't think about the past.
Well, Rena, what I want to ask you is maybe even a little bit theological. I know you're married to such a holy rabbi, Rabbi Emanuel Quint.
He's wonderful.
He's amazing. And you yourself, an Orthodox Jewish woman, a great grandmother of so many beautiful Jews here in Israel. How are you not, you know, angry at God? How are you not consumed with hate for human beings? You walk around and you're just like a ray of light, of love, sharing the goodness that you have in your heart to the rest of everyone that meets you, loves you. How are you not consumed with, you know, just the terrible life that you lived? How do you live like that?
Well, I can think of the terrible life that I had, or I can think about the wonderful life I have right now. And as you said, I have children, grandchildren. I have a wonderful husband who feels that I was saved for him. He makes me the kind of feeling. I don't think that I have to forgive them, the Germans. I don't think I have to forget. But I also can't hate, because if I hate, I'll go around this. Do I hate God? No. I love God for saving me. I don't understand how he could have let this happen to the Jewish people. I don't understand how the Germans, who are also his people, could have acted like such animals, worse than animals. Animals have some compassion. I don't understand that. But I feel that I want to be a good Jew. I like being a good Jew. I like living in Israel. I like having Friday night and Shabbat, and I like bringing people in. It's a very special day, a special holiday. I can't do it without believing in God. So I want to think of the good, the kindest God, and just not understand. I mean, we can ask questions and not expect the answers all the time.
I'll tell you just the emotional experience I'm having is that I'm feeling tears welling up in my eyes. And what's it from? I mean, I know it's from the story you're telling, but as I'm looking at you, you know, you're a great grandmother, but I'm seeing these flashes of 6-year-old Rena Quint. And when you're telling these stories and you're saying, I had all the, when I was in New York, I had all the food I want. Just, you were just like thrown from one place to another. And there's all of this talk and chatter and strategizing about what to do with you. You're drinking water from puddles and you're just so grateful for being able to have food. I mean, the innocence, it's just really devastating. And I'll tell you that it would, many people I know don't like going back there, don't like talking about the Holocaust or sharing it. And I know that you're going from speech to speech to speech. What motivates you to do that? Why you're saying again and again, be grateful for what I have and moving on. Why do you allow yourself to be pulled back into it?
I think the Fredja Lichtenstein, who was in Poland, is not the Rena Quint who's today. I know that there are two, but they were like two of me. I think going back to Poland is very important. First of all, the people who are buried there, they should have somebody come to say they're there, just like you go to a cemetery here, and you don't know whether the people hear you, but you know that you're there for them. They should also know. I also think the Polish people should realize that Jews are still here. We went back a few years ago, and my husband was wearing a kippah against my better issues. I would prefer he was wearing a hat, but he was wearing a kippah, and we were sitting on a well. We had just come out of a, it was a theater, which had been once a synagogue, and it was very depressing, and a man came over, and he was pointing to my husband's kippah, and he had two little children with him, and I said, are you wondering what that is? And I knew he was an anti-Semite. And he said, oh, no, I know what it is. I've met Jews when I was a little boy, but my children never saw a Jew. And I wanted to show them this man was a Jew, and you can tell because he's wearing this. And then he took us to his house. He was an artist. And I thought, because I really didn't believe very much, that he wanted to sell us his paintings. That's why he was being so nice. No, he apparently was a successful man. And he lived in a house with a pond in the middle of his house. And he says, do you know what this is? It was a mikveh.
That's what he said to
you. Yeah, it was. Yeah, he knew it.
Oh, he knew it.
But his children had no idea. Why shouldn't the Poles see this? Also, by going to back to Poland, the Polish people have erected monuments. There's a monument of Mila 18. There are stops all the way. We talked about the Umschlagplatz. You have all these things. This is a reminder. Let the world know that we once lived. Poland used to be called Poline. There's a new museum there. And it meant here Jews lived. They thought they were safe there. Unfortunately, they weren't safe there or any place else in Europe. And we wonder what's happening now.
You know, we're so grateful that you've joined us for this interview. I know that you don't do interviews on the media so often, but I know you were starting to tell us a story about an interview you did in South Africa.
I was invited to South Africa 2 years ago. My husband wasn't well, so I went with my grandson because my family didn't want to go alone, and he was wonderful helping me. And I was interviewed for magazines, and I spoke in Johannesburg and in Durban and in Cape Town. But in Johannesburg, I was invited to a station called SAFM, and the man there told me that it was going to be a call-in where they were going to call in and ask me questions. And they were going to ask me questions that were not going to be very flattering to Israelis. They were going to ask me a lot about apartheid. And I came prepared to tell them. And I came to show them that we have Arab Knesset members and that we have judges who are Arabs. And there are malls and our hospitals are open to Jews and Arabs. I was really ready to share this with them. But he didn't take any calls in because he was interested in hearing my story. But he let one man, he was a big black man who was in charge of the correctional facilities, 10,000 inmates. And he asked if I would come to Durban to speak in prison. And I had never done this before. And my grandson, who wears his tzitzit and his kippah, was wearing them. And we went to this prison. And it was a terrible feeling because the doors, metal things were closed, and you went into a place that was open and closed and open. And we came in and we started singing all these hymns of Jesus. And I said, what are we doing here? But they were preparing for us, and they were thinking we were coming as holy. And I spoke in English, and he translated to Swahili. He called my speech a motivational speech. Now, why did he want me to? He felt as he was listening that these people are giving up. They've done terrible crimes. That's why they're in jail. And if you're in jail and you're going to be incarcerated, what's the sense of going on? And he wanted them to show that no matter what happened, there's always a chance for rehabilitating your life and going out. And you have to be motivated to try to live your life to the fullest. And I try to do that.
You know, you speak to so many groups, you know, Yad Vashem, Konstef, like every time that I calling you, you're coming from one talk or going to another talk. But if you had a goal, the message that you have, then people that meet you, that hear your life story, what do you want people to walk away with?
Well, first of all, that there's always hope. But second of all, what I would like our young people to do is Hitler wanted to wipe out all the people, all of the Jewish people. He didn't think there would be a man, woman, or Jewish child left. He succeeded in killing 6 million of our people. But by assimilating and intermarrying, we're giving him posthumous victory. We can't do that. We can't let the Jewish people get less and less by doing that. So what I would like each and every young Jewish person to meet another young Jewish person and to make sure that their spouse is, I don't care if they're religious or not religious, but to marry other Jews and bring Jewish children in and make sure that a population grows and make sure that Israel is safe and free so that if any Jew needs to come here, there is a place. If we only had an Israel in 1939, there would have been a difference in 40 and 41. And that's a very, very big, important dream. And I think that many places like Birthright and other groups are working on that.
Yeah.
And I hope it will succeed.
Well, you know, anti-Semitism is now on the rise around the world. You know, in France, there was 100% increase in anti-Semitic violent attacks in Germany, in Holland. All these reports are coming out again. Do you feel like maybe the Jewish people may experience something similar to a Holocaust even in our own modern age? Or that just can't happen again?
I don't know if it can't happen. I don't know how it could ever have happened in the first place. But I think that now, first of all, we have a country. We have a government. Whether we like them or not, we have a government. We have a way of protecting ourselves. And so there's more of a chance of it. We had nothing. We had nobody there. Now, at least we have to be our own friends. What's happening in Europe is very, very frightening. And I think it's frightening for the Jews, and I think it's frightening for people like Christians also. The Islamic movement is trying to take over the world, and that's very, very frightening.
You know, there's a poll done in Israel. 80% of Israelis believe that one day the Holocaust will be forgotten. It will fade from our consciousness, our memory, which is a
80% of Israelis think that?
4 out of 5.
Wow, that's a shocking poll.
Yeah, it really is a shocking poll. For me, it's shocking because considering the memory, the collective memory of the Jewish people, how we still sit down and rip our shirts and feel the pain of the destruction of the temple from thousands of years ago, to think that the Holocaust would be forgotten, but 80% feel like perhaps not forgotten, but it will stop being in the daily consciousness and in the forefront of the Jewish mind and Jewish consciousness. So do you feel that that's a possibility?
It could be a possibility. As time goes on, you forget more. But that's why we have an obligation now. And that's why I feel that anybody who asks me to speak, I'm willing to speak and to say how important it is. I also think there was a new movement that I heard about today that the second generation found it very hard to deal with the Holocaust. Their parents had a hard time and they really didn't want to put themselves in difficulty. But the third generation, which means our grandchildren, should be taking over now. And I think that in my particular family, they do. They speak more about it. They ask me. They send their friends. And in Israel, there's a bagrut, which is an examination on history, and there's a special section on the Holocaust. And they have to interview a Holocaust survivor. So at least when the Holocaust survivors, they claim that 15,000 Holocaust survivors die every year. Like over 1,000 a month. But that's true of the general population. Most of us are in the 80s and 90s. So it's just, that's what life is about. But we have to get the young people to say how important it is for us to remember and not to forget.
What do you think about the Germans alive today? Do we have a special message for them? I mean, the grandchildren of the Nazis, on one hand, you know, they're grandchildren of just like the scum of the earth, the filth, the most disgusting human beings maybe ever to live, and they're grandchildren of that. Should we be merciful to them? Should we try to remind them of it? What should we do with the modern-day German youth that's growing up today?
I have met quite a few of them. As a matter of fact, I was interviewed for the Spiegel, and it's online now, and I just hosted the 22 journalists from Germany. These people, the people who come to Israel, are not our enemies. They take the responsibility of what their parents, or mostly grandparents, did. And they can't believe. I mean, they're ashamed of their grandparents. Of course, you have skinheads and people who hate us who won't come to Israel. But we have them in other places also. But I don't think that the people who have come to Israel, who are trying to make amends for what their grandparents did, that we have to push them away. And I think you have to welcome them.
Sure. Well, so on Yom HaShoah now, as far as the Jewish people living here in the land of Israel, what should we do here in Israel now? Should we be calling the Jews in Europe to make Aliyah? Should we just say, like, be strong and don't let it happen again by staying there and being a proud Jew in Europe? Or should we say, like, listen, it's rough in France now. Just get out and come home.
I think our telling them is not going to help very much. I think everybody has to make the decision for themselves. I think that many of the Jews in the 30s realized what was happening, but they sort of felt, Gamze Yavor, this will all pass, and they saw they didn't. And I think the Jews in France, if you notice, a lot of people are buying up apartments here.
Yes, they are.
Both for financial reasons as well as for the future in case they have to run. People stay in places. People stay in Russia because of money, because of their earnings, because they're afraid to come here because of the language, because they won't find jobs, because of different things. Rabbi Lau once told a story. Do we have time?
Yes,
for you?
Yes, please.
Rabbi Lau went with the European rabbis to Russia, and he met an old Jewish man, and the Jewish man followed him around, and he said, you know, this is the most Jewishness I've had since the Holocaust. And Rabbi Lau says, why don't you come to Israel? You'll have it all around you. It won't cost you anything. And the man said, I can't. And Rabbi Lau says, if you're afraid that you won't find a job, I'll help you find a job. That's not it. If you're afraid you won't find a place to live, I'll help you. I'll help you with this. I'll help you. He says, you don't understand. I have one Jewish daughter. She was Jewish, every other murdered, and she had a child. That child is Jewish. I'm the only one who's telling her that she's Jewish. Once I'm gone, there won't be anybody to remind her, so I have to do that. So he's giving up his way of life to help her. But many of the Jews in France and Britain feel very comfortable there, or if they don't, they don't know about coming to them. I don't know that we can tell them to come. We can certainly make it palatable and we can welcome them,
sure,
but they have to make that decision.
Well, in your talks, have you ever encountered, even today, I mean, the chutzpah to even think of that, but an anti-Semite out through and through as you've given a talk and they've just come out either aggressive or violent against you?
No, but they haven't asked me to speak. The people who asked me to speak are on my side.
That's...
So I don't know.
Well, I have this theory as I traverse the world. I see a pattern. It's not officially statistically sound, I don't think, but that Holocaust survivors do present a disproportionate number of very successful businessmen. And I have this theory that it comes from this place of they've been at the very, very bottom. They know what it is to have nothing. And hence, by knowing that, they're not afraid of it. And when you don't have fears, you're able to accomplish tremendous things. I'm wondering if this journey of life of yours, the fact that you were at the bottom so early, did that somehow relinquish fears later on? I'm also interested in hearing about your Aliyah. When you made Aliyah, did you have fears about that?
No, but I was very lucky. I had a husband who was a lawyer, a successful lawyer. We came here, we bought an apartment, we bought a car. We didn't have to look for jobs. We were retired. Our children were going to school and they were going to start. Of course, they could make much more money living in Israel than here
in America
than here. But we decided to come here. And I I think that if I would have children in school with homework, it'd be hard. If I would have to find a job, it would be hard. So for me, it was not hard. We had been coming here since 69, and we brought our children up by going to B'nai Akiva, and Israel was always part of our life. And I love living in Israel, and I find that it's a very easy life. And I find that maybe you have more money in America, and maybe you need more or something like that. But I wouldn't change anything. I wouldn't. I mean, we've been living here for a long time, and our children and our grandchildren, most of our children are living here. We have three grandchildren in America in very prestigious schools. We have one in Columbia. Her husband is in Harvard now, so maybe she's there. One in Stanford and one in Princeton.
Wow.
Hopefully, when they finish that, they will join us.
Wow. Folks, you've met Rena Quint, my mother's best friend, a dear friend of our families, but really an example of Jewish perseverance, of the Jewish story that no matter how hard life is, no matter how bad it could get, you can make just a work of art out of life.
And she's a great grandmother. Talk about the ultimate revenge against Hitler. Forget all the never again signs. Great grandchildren throughout the world in the land of Israel and Jerusalem. She's the ultimate testimony to who was victorious in that war and who was not. Who God is with and who God is not.
I think when you think of 6 million being killed, it's more than 6 million. Those 6 million would have had children and grandchildren. From one person like myself, we have 43 people. We have 4 children and 22 grandchildren, and that is, we have to continue that.
Thank you all for tuning in today.